Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. Two laws recently passed by the Oregon legislature promised to have significant impacts on the state's criminal justice system. The first will require that Oregon begin recording all grand jury proceedings rather than relying on handwritten juror notes. Supporters argue that recording the proceedings will provide more thorough and accurate documentation, while opponents, notably Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis, contend that such recordings will have a silencing effect on crime victims. Second, and no less contentious law, reclassifies possession of small amounts of some hard drugs, including heroin and methamphetamine. In the studio to discuss the pros and cons of both laws are District Attorney Josh Marquis and Astoria defense lawyer Mary Ann Merck. Marquis has served as the county's DA since 1994, while Merck has practiced law in the county for nearly 20 years, specializing in adult and juvenile criminal defense. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Josh and Mary Ann.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I'd like to start by discussing the new law requiring that grand jury proceedings be recorded. And for those who may not be familiar with the process, what is a grand jury?
Well, the grand jury exists in most states, although how it's formed, essentially in Oregon, like many things in Oregon, it's sort of populist. They are seven people chosen at absolute random out of the general jury pool. And many of your listeners probably have served on grand jury in Oregon at some point. In Clatsop County, they meet every 2 months. And in most of Oregon, including Clatsop County, all felony cases have been, up till now, submitted through the grand jury. The grand jury is a secret proceeding. It's a one-sided proceeding. The defense is not there. They generally don't have a right to present evidence. So the only people present are the district attorney and the witness. And essentially, the grand jury is, to be blunt, a reality check on the prosecutor. If five or more of the grand jurors decide there's enough evidence to go forward, they indicate it's a true bill and the case proceeds. If less than five people believe that there's enough evidence, it's a not true bill and the case dies forever. There was tremendous controversy about the grand jury, maybe the only real controversy in this county 24 years ago when my predecessor, Julie Lenhart, essentially lied to the grand jury and presented essentially phony evidence, which resulted in the indictment of two innocent Astoria officers who eventually were cleared. And Ms. Lenhart, the district attorney, was herself arrested, indicted, convicted, jailed, and disbarred for her conduct. So the grand jury in many states is made up of as many as 23 people, often nominated by judges. In Oregon, it's different.
So isn't it imbalanced if only the prosecutor is inside a grand jury?
It is imbalanced. I mean, there's no question that the grand jury process, as it's formed in Oregon and most states, is really not part of the judicial system. It's part of the charging system. And there are U.S. Supreme Court cases that talk about this. So if one were to say, is it a completely fair proceeding, I have to say, no, it's not. It's one-sided. And it relies on the integrity of the prosecutor, for example, to only present evidence, which is the rules, that we could present in court. In other words, we can't put somebody on and say, well, tell us what somebody else said. That's hearsay. So inherently, a grand jury proceeding is fairly one-sided, yes.
Mary Ann, you may not want to speak for all defense lawyers, but do you have a sense of how defense lawyers feel about this new law?
Well, I mean, what we also have to keep in mind in looking at the grand jury is it's like an artifact of an old district court, circuit court system. And so it's a probable cause findings. And I explain that to my client is basically the grand jury is looking at, you know, even just a portion of the evidence and making a decision as to whether it's more likely than not a crime's been committed. And it's more likely than not that the person named is who committed that crime. So it's not a proof beyond the reasonable doubt standard. It's a way to get the case moving through the system. I think that defense attorneys have been frustrated in the past by the lack of access to information at the grand jury because, you know, there are frequently times where we don't know what's been said at the grand jury. And in many situations, we have cases where we have alleged victims who have told two or three different versions of events, and we don't know which version of that events has gone into the grand jury or if a completely different version of events has gone to the grand jury. So I think, in general, defense attorneys tend to favor recording of witness testimony. I think that it leads to more transparency within the process, in the same way that, you know, defense attorneys are entitled to the police reports or the police recordings that say this is what people said. We do feel like we should be able to have the information about what was said in front of a grand jury for purposes of transparency and preparing our defense for our clients. And so I think in general, defense attorneys favor it. The other issue is that there has been a lot of case law, as Josh has said, surrounding the grand jury process and, you know, what level of accountability district attorneys have within the scope of presenting information to a grand jury. And it's hard to know when there isn't a recording whether or not the rules of evidence were followed. And, you know, frankly, the reason we have judges making decisions about rules of evidence is because not all attorneys agree as to what is admissible evidence. And so a DA may believe that evidence they're presenting is admissible, but a judge might not agree with that. And so the only way that that can be reviewed is if we have recordings to look at it. And because we haven't in the past, we haven't been able to really challenge the evidence that's presented in a grand jury proceeding. So defense attorneys, I believe, tend to favor this process.
Okay. Josh, you have written that this law could have a silencing effect on victims. How so?
Well, in several ways. I also need to make clear that although I'm in favor, I'm against this. When I wrote that op-ed in the Oregonian a month ago, I was speaking on behalf of all of Oregon's district attorneys except one. So this is not just an outlier opinion that I hold. The concern we have, I'd agree with many of the things Mary Ann said, and as I've been a defense attorney, and if I was a defense attorney, I'd want those things too. But keep in mind that many times grand jury is both economical, I mean, for the system. It's relatively quick, relatively inexpensive. Under this new system, which will go into effect in Clatsop County and 33 other counties not until July of 2019, goes into effect for three counties in March of next year. Essentially, the burden will be entirely on the district attorney and the grand jurors. Oregon will be the only state in the nation that requires a grand juror to operate a recording system, which is going to be relied on heavily because it won't simply be, as Mary Ann said, an occasional note. This will be required to be verbatim recordings of every question asked, every answer given, every colloquy or discussion between. And to answer your question, what are we concerned about? When you have particularly domestic violence victims, victims of child abuse, victims in cases where people in positions of power, whether they're government officials or not, are accused of crime, particularly in a small community. As a prosecutor for almost 30 years, I can tell you from my own experience that many victims are very reluctant to come forward. They're convinced either that, you know, the person who they're talking about is going to find out immediately what they've said. And even before there's a legal proceeding, like a formal arraignment, which eventually, as Mary Ann will no doubt point out, as she said, we have to give the police report. So the statements that the alleged victim made will eventually get to the defendant and the defense attorney. This will make it different. This will make it so that essentially within about, I think, 10 days of the arraignment, every word they've said. I've spoken to many grand jurors, because this is the third time they've tried to get this bill passed, and now they succeeded. Without exception, every grand juror I've spoken to after they've served has said they're bitterly opposed to it, that it would make them question about whether they would be willing to serve on grand jury, particularly in a small community. Because then the answer is, well, so if I ask questions about, let's say, Mr. Big Shot, who's accused of anything from felony drunk driving to something really serious like sex abuse, so everybody's going to know who I am, what I said. Now,
would they be identified grand jurors?
Well, it would be kind of meaningless unless they were identified. Now, in honesty, grand jurors' identities are not secret now. It is possible, although very unusual, for lawyers or defendants to find out who's on the grand jury except the presiding juror. But that's going to change significantly. The other thing that's going to change is that most of us, meaning elected DAs, are prepared to switch to a preliminary hearing system to avoid this for a couple reasons. One, to spread the cost out so it's not entirely absorbed by the counties and the DAs. And secondly, if we're going to have a hearing where we put, say, a victim of sex abuse on the stand, and all of their statements are going to go to Marianne or another skilled defense attorney like her, who is then going to obviously prepare for cross-examination, why not just do it once? Because frankly, and in court, everybody can see it. The big difference is grand jury testimony cannot be used by the prosecution at trial. Preliminary hearing testimony can be.
I'm still not sure why you would need to go to the preliminary hearing process. Recording equipment isn't that complicated nowadays, is it?
Well, we're talking about recording this system much more elaborate than we're using in here. And if you want to know what kind, all you need to do is walk into a courtroom and see what the courts are using. That's a 4-microphone system. And in most of the courts, there's 1 to 2 full-time staff members making sure that it operates, that it captures the voices. You have 7 grand jurors, a prosecutor, and a witness. And although most of the statements are going to be made by the ones that probably matter the most are the ones made by the witness, certainly the questions are going to matter. So you're going to have 9 microphone points. And again, as our lobbyist said when we were debating this in the legislature, he turned to the legislature and said, well, if it's so easy, why do you have a staff person here recording your meeting?
Good point. All right. The silencing effect, wouldn't it be fairly obvious to a defendant, or maybe he's not, or she is not quite a defendant if she hasn't been charged, who was bringing the accusations against them?
Well, yes. I mean, to be clear, now a grand jury indictment right now contains the name of every has to contain the name of every person who testified in a grand jury. And a fundamental part of the Fifth Amendment to the Oregon and U.S. constitutions, which is the defendant has a right to face their witnesses. A defense attorney and defendant now have the right to know who testified. What they don't have a right to, as Marianne pointed out, were the details of what that person said and the nuances of what that person said.
But on the other hand, I mean, most felony cases, people are charged through information, which is a document that is presented based on the district attorney's information and belief. And subsequent to the information being served, that then goes through the grand jury process. In reality, the defendant knows well before the grand jury is convened who the accuser is in most cases, and has a pretty good idea of what the facts of the case are prior to that grand jury process. And so I don't necessarily see a chilling effect on victims. They've already made statements to police officers. They've frequently made statements to doctors. They've gone and done, in the case of children, child abuse assessments. Maybe there's been DHS people that have interviewed them. And all that documentation goes to the defense attorney. And so I don't necessarily perceive a chilling effect. I do understand the issue of cost, but if the DAs all switch to preliminary hearing, the reality is our courtrooms are going to be stuffed full on the docket with preliminary hearings, and it's going to cause an extremely chilling effect on the ability of these cases to move forward. As it is, we can hardly get cases set for even a plea and sentencing on our docket in a timely manner, much less, you know, if we then have preliminary hearings on how many hundreds of felony charges.
About 500 a year.
That are filed. The court system,
and that's in this county,
cannot absorb that. And frankly, the defense bar cannot absorb that. We simply would not have the resources on the judicial or the defense side to do that. And I don't believe the DA's office would have the resources to do that.
Okay. Well, since it doesn't take effect in this county for 2 years, is it possible the legislature might come back with more funding for a staff person to operate the recording equipment?
It's possible. This bill had many, many permutations, and frankly, the requirement that a grand juror do it was almost a grudge match by one of the sponsors, Floyd Prusansky, who is not fond of prosecutors. We countered, meaning the DAs, with, well, what about a proposal to allow, say, a DA staff member to be in? That was rejected. What about having someone from the court? That was rejected. One of the big issues is, what is the cost? The pilot project in 3 counties is roughly been allocated $10 million. The question is, what will it cost for the other 33? And yes, presumably in the intervening 2 years, Multnomah County, which is the biggest county in the state, will report back what their experience is. And I think there's at least a possibility that it might be revisited.
Okay. If you're just joining me, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview with Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis and Astoria criminal defense lawyer Marianne Merck. They are discussing two new laws affecting the criminal justice system in Oregon. One requires that grand jury proceedings be recorded for the first time in the state's history. The other, which we'll talk about now, reclassifies possession of small amounts of hard drugs, including heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. I do want to transition now to talking about another law affecting the criminal justice system just passed by the legislature, and that is the reclassification of hard drugs, possession of small amounts of them, from felonies to misdemeanors. Marianne, I'd like to start with you. What are your feelings on that?
You know, as a defense attorney, I find it very hard to, I mean, I agree with a lot of the legislators who have commented that their concern was labeling people who are addicts and need treatment as felons. And I don't think it is useful to label the number of people that we are labeling as felons in our community, in our state, I mean, across the nation, by taking user amounts and classifying them as felonies. On the other hand, reclassifying them to misdemeanors and only in certain circumstances to felonies, I think I have concerns about how that then motivates people into treatment programs. I can tell you from a defense side that it is extremely likely that a lot of defendants will be saying, I just want a straight sentence. I'm not doing probation. Get me whatever you can from the DA and get me out of jail. And so I feel that there's not going to be kind of the same incentives to avoid felony convictions through conditional discharge as there are currently in place. So I think it's a double-edged sword. I know that one of the things that the legislator talked about was, well, we're trying to motivate people to treatment by doing this. And I'm not clear how they think this is going to motivate people to treatment. The other thing that I found really interesting in kind of not the legislative, well, in the legislative debate, but also in the just kind of the colloquy that you see in newspapers and that type of thing about how we're trying to reduce the impact on the prison sentence system of sending people with small quantities of drugs to prison. The reality is that Oregon does not send people in those circumstances to prison. They get probation. Frequently, they get conditional discharges, which allow them to avoid conviction if they do treatment and follow through with those things. And they maybe get 10 to 90 days in custody in a local jail. So I don't think that this bill is going to have the net impact of reducing the prison population. And so I'm kind of fascinated by the debate I read surrounding this, because I think it represents a lack of understanding about how the criminal laws in the state actually work. So
interesting. Josh?
Well, I agree with many of the things Marianne said, which might surprise people, but that there's often more agreement between prosecutors and defense attorneys than people expect. I was one of the few witnesses. I was bitterly opposed to this bill. A little bit of history. The bill itself is actually 18 pages long. The first 9 pages are not controversial, and they deal with racial profiling and require police to keep more detailed information about the ethnicity, gender, and racial identity of people they stop. The second part, frankly, seems to have nothing to do with the first part, and it essentially defelonizes. And as Marianne said, and I won't beat it to death, you don't go to prison in Oregon for mere possession. Now, there are states in the country where that happens, and I think those states are nuts. The idea of making someone who is a mere addict go to prison is just not a good use of prison. But on the other hand, also as Marianne says, there is a coercive effect to having the possibility of a felony. That's what drug court's all about. Drug court is essentially, and it isn't limited to first time or even second or third time. So somebody gets caught with, and most addicts can't afford, by the way, 10-day supply. They're lucky if they can get from day to day to day. That's all they can afford. So we're talking about usually a minuscule amount, maybe part of a gram of heroin, let's say. And they're addicts. And what happens now is they come in, they get arrested, They go to a defense attorney. The defense attorney explains that they could go into drug court. Now, drug court's not a walk in the park. They have to go into court every week. They have to go. They have to be compliant with a treatment program. They're going to get urinalysis tests, and when they flunk, which they will, because addiction is not something you just overcome in a week. You know, there's what they call micro sanctions, which could be a couple days in jail several times. So it's a steep road. But at the end of that road, if they stay sober for 6 months and complete the program, not only they don't have a felony conviction, the whole case is dismissed. And as Marianne correctly said, I said this over and over, never got us at it. How are you going to incentivize these people to do this? Now, one of the statements made appallingly, in my opinion, by the Attorney General was, well, this disenfranchises people. Well, a lot of people, particularly the ACLU, for reasons that I understand, are concerned about taking away people's rights to vote. Well, there are places in America, nowhere near here, Florida, where any felony conviction ever means you can't vote again. Oregon is not one of those states. The only way you lose your right to vote in Oregon is if you're currently in a state prison for a felony. The minute you're released, you're free to vote and run for office again. So, as Marianne says, the two things that presumably were big drivers of this, one, a stigma like, you know, losing your right to vote, or worse yet, going to prison, they simply don't apply. And part of the problem is we have almost no practitioners of criminal law as either defense attorneys or prosecutors in the legislature. Virtually none of them have ever practiced criminal law on either side.
That's surprising.
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe because it's a citizen legislature. I mean, for reasons Marianne and I would probably agree with, I have no desire to be in the legislature. I won't speak for Marianne. But I think this bill goes into effect immediately. I think it's going to be a disaster because what we're really doing, we have a terrible heroin and meth crisis in Oregon and in this county. And it crosses, although it's concentrated, frankly, in poor communities more, it does cross a lot of, social lines. And I don't know what else we can do about it, but what we are doing with this bill is we are saying to a subset of the community that possession on your first or second usable quantity or ever on what they call residue cases, which are often all we catch somebody with, which is the scrapings inside a pipe or something like that. Those would be misdemeanors forever. And under the law, on your third conviction of a usable amount, it could be a felony. But what we're really saying, I think, is, okay, to the community, and particularly the community that might be at risk, we're going to classify this exactly as seriously as a misdemeanor shoplifting, which is a theft too, or a criminal mischief in the second degree, which is a vandalism where somebody, let's say, paints something on the side of a building and it costs $300-$400 to repair. Those are both Class A misdemeanors. And I just have a really hard time as a prosecutor and as a citizen thinking of the ongoing possession of heroin and meth as being that unserious.
Okay. Is there adequate treatment available here in the county for addiction?
No. I think Marianne and I would totally agree with that. There's virtually no inpatient treatment. There are, I think, three private providers. And if I remember correctly, and I think they do a really good job, at least the ones I know of in Astoria, which have both the men and women's facility, one of which is very close to here physically, the studio, is that I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's $9,000 the first month, $8,000 the second, and $7,000 the third. So, you know, $24,000 for a 90-day facility. Then the amount of treatment even that we have behind that is minimal. One of the issues that's highly controversial is what's called medication-assisted therapy, which I personally think is a good idea, but there's a lot of resistance in the so-called AA community to it. Medication-assisted therapy is things like methadone and a relatively new drug called Suboxone. And the argument against it is, well, this is just trading one addiction for another. The argument for it is, hey, if somebody can live a life without having to slam a needle into their arm with all the health risks associated with that, why not have a doctor prescribe a drug that will tamp down their addiction?
Did you have something to add, Marianne?
Well, I just think in general, even if we're just looking at outpatient services, we're in a situation where we don't have enough services to fill the need. We have a significant number of medically related health crises that I see in my client populations, young kids in their 20s who are having heart attacks and hospitalized for months and months on end as a result of an inability to address their addiction, people on wait lists for indigent defense beds that are, you know, 90 to 120 days down the road before they can get into them. Obviously, we don't have a detox program locally. We most of our clients rely on payment through Oregon Health Plan. Oregon Health Plan, as I think everybody knows, has that Medicaid expansion, which may or may not be going away, which a lot of our clients depend on for treatment. Even on sliding fee scales, our clients can frequently not come up with the money to do outpatient. And the wait list, even for outpatient to get in, is, you know, pretty lengthy. And our treatment providers simply don't have the number of people that they need to provide that treatment. Additionally, there's not a lot of people looking for those jobs because they are very low-paying jobs. I mean, I have talked to people and I've said, why are you doing that? You could make more money waiting tables at Carruthers than you're making providing services to this population.
In a treatment center?
Yeah, people with master's degrees doing outpatient treatment for places like Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare. They're really underpaid and they're really overworked. And so it's, I think, just an ongoing struggle that Oregon has in trying to meet that treatment need. I don't think that's unusual to Clatsop County. I mean, I came from a county that was in much worse shape than Clatsop County.
Okay.
Is, so.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, and correct me if I'm not, you're saying that addicts convicted of possession would rather serve a few days in jail or a small jail term than have to go through drug court.
Sure.
I can guarantee that.
Yeah. And the reason is, I mean, people say if you're looking at it as a sober person who wants the person to be in recovery, you'd say, well, why didn't they want to go into a treatment program? Because they're addicted.
Because they're drug addicts.
They're drug addicts. They're thinking in terms of they're going to get very sick. They're going to go through withdrawal, which is not going to kill them, but they're going to feel like they were dying. And so one of the things, the cognitive disconnects about addiction is people say, okay, I just want to feel okay till tomorrow. And they say correctly, I can't hold down a job if I'm in withdrawal. I can't do anything. So I just want to get well. And the answer to that, unfortunately, is heroin has gotten so cheap. When I was in law enforcement 40 years ago in Eugene, it cost about $25 for a dose of heroin. It's now $3. And it is so inexpensive, we are not seeing people pause at prescription drugs anymore. We're seeing them go what I call from 0 to 60 right away. You have young people who are going straight to injectable heroin, which is frightening. And as Marianne says, there's all kinds of downstream medical consequences. One of the reasons you get these heart conditions is if you inject crud into your body, it ends up piling up around the heart, and you end up with the heart of an 85-year-old man when you're 20 years old. There's hep C, there's lots of other bad things.
Well, and a lot of these individuals end up dead. I've had clients who are in their early 20s who died. And it's really sad because I like a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis and Astoria criminal defense lawyer Marianne Merck for discussing two new laws affecting the criminal justice system in Oregon. Thank you, Josh and Marianne.
Thank you.
Josh Marquis has been Clatsop County's district attorney since 1994, while Marianne Merck has practiced law in the county for nearly 20 years, specializing in adult and juvenile criminal defense. They were discussing the pros and cons of two new laws recently passed by the Oregon legislature, one requiring the recording of grand jury proceedings, and the second law reclassifying possession of small amounts of hard drugs from felonies to misdemeanors. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. Perspectives can be heard every other Friday on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you have an idea for a show, email me at perspectives@coastradio.org. Perspectives was engineered today, as it has been many times, by Kate Brister. I want to thank Kate for all the support she has given me in getting Perspectives off the ground in the show's first year. You will be missed, Kate.